Okay, so last week when we talked about Empire Strikes Back, you know, we started out saying that you kind of didn't think it was a great movie, and I really like Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think at this point I kind of have a sense of what you like and what you don't like, and I don't really care for Return of the Jedi.
I don't really either. It's a series of very well-done action sequences along with, I mean, I know one of the things we really liked about Star Wars was the meanderingness of it. It's a very sprawling movie, you know, it's kind of, but here it just feels kind of aimless. Like, the whole stuff in Jabba's palace, like, it's, you know, they're trying to recapture what they had in that cantina scene, which is so iconic, you know, and, you know, while I'm impressed with all the creature design, it's, I guess it kind of clicked for me last night that, the creatures in Star Wars serve to make the universe feel very, you know, strange and, you know,
cartoonish.
Yeah, there's a lot of well, I wouldn't even say cartoonish. It just it establishes this as a very exotic world. There are a lot of strange creatures. You know, there are species that, you know, you can't even imagine that you see, you know, and it's all just anything can happen in this universe. Like, it gives a sense of mystery to it, I find. In this, it's just all about the creatures. It's just all about showing off, you know, that it doesn't really seem, because we already know what kind of a universe this is. We've seen two films of it. Here, it just seems very, I don't know, just what's the point, you know?
Yeah, what is the point? I mean, you know, I don't want to be too hard on the movie, but I think that you know, it's our obligation to say what we really think. And yeah, I think the creature stuff is a good way to get into the conversation, because I just find all of the creature stuff to be very tiring. Like,
yeah,
it struck me watching it, you know, last night, that I think really what this shows is this may be the beginning of George Lucas showing his lack of restraint. And, you know, he was obviously very involved in Return of the Jedi. He didn't direct it, but, you know, there's kind of scuttlebutt that he directed some of it. Because it was just such a big production, you know, there was, you know, different, they filmed it, I think, over like, it was like 3 months or something. And, you know, they did it in Tunisia and they did it in California, yeah, and all over the place, right? In England. So they needed directors that were going to work in different places, but the creatures are just, I don't know, I find them very tiresome. Like, I don't think that they're all that, you know, interesting. And there's a lot of
toys,
them,
you know?
Right. And you know, that's really actually interesting that you say that, because, you know, I always do a little bit of research before we, you know, record a podcast. And one of the things that I saw was, you know, Lawrence Kasdan, who co-wrote this script and also co-wrote Empire Strikes Back, wanted to kill Han Solo in the middle of the movie. Mm-hmm. And George Lucas kind of vetoed that because he thought that it would hurt the merchandising. So yeah, you can already start to see that happening with Star Wars. I think that George Lucas realized that this was his money train, and he didn't want to derail it, basically.
Well, I mean, that's how George Lucas made his money, really. I mean, he was able to, you know, no one expected Star Wars really to do well, and he was able to slip, you know, famously was able to slip in a, he got all of the proceeds, you know, profits from the merchandise, and, you know, the studio didn't, you know, really think that would be a thing. Like, all right, you know, that's fine. When it's not that. And of course, you know,
and
when it turned out to be a huge hit, you know, he made money from all of the toys. So yeah.
And I mean, good for him. I mean,
he took
the risk on Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. He self-financed both of those movies. Yeah. But there is sort of a cynicism to it. You know, it's I think Return of the Jedi, more than Empire Strikes Back, or definitely more than Star Wars, is less of a movie than it is a vehicle for toy sales. And, you know, there's a lot of the movie that just feels very calculated to not upset the delicate balance of the juggernaut that Star Wars had become by 1983.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, looking at it from 30 years later, it's a movie that has some serious problems, I think.
I would say in terms of the creature-y stuff, I mean, the Sarlacc bit is probably the most successful. I mean, that's certainly my favorite bit of the movie. Like, that's when, you know, I felt the same way about the Hoth sequences in Empire, but I don't feel like the movie starts until they finally get to the Sarlacc pit. And
yeah,
I mean, the creature is, it's certainly part of it. You know, we're certainly, it certainly gives a lot to wonder about, like, oh my God, that's horrible, digested over 1,000 years and apparently conscious for that and has these horrible teeth. But it's, again, it's not the focus of the scene. The focus of the scene is not, look at this horrible, but it's everything. It's, you know, another danger, you know. It's along the lines of Han Solo's blind during this fight, you know, and he has, you know, his other set of problems, you know. So,
right.
You know, the Rancor Beast sequence is just, you know, oh, let's show off a Muppet, you know, the performances in the
which is actually interesting because I think, you know, it's, well, it's not a Muppet, number one, it's stop motion, but
yeah,
you know, I think that you know, George Lucas actually wanted to use like a live puppet in that scene, I think, or something like that, and it just didn't work.
Yeah,
so they actually went with the stop motion thing. I think,
very cool looking. I mean, I will say that, like, well, in terms of Muppetry and stop motion, you know, stuff, everything is very, it looks very cool, but
technically it's, yes, technically it's great. I mean, you know, the stop motion, the puppets, you know, all of the action sequences are done very, very well. I don't think that there was a movie that was doing this better in 1983. You know, I think that this the scenes on Endor with the speeders and the race and stuff like that, I mean, that's still very impressive.
I would say the entire movie still looks really good, you know, but after a point it's, you know, where does the movie end and just the technical demo begin, you know what I mean? Like, this is essentially a demo reel of stuff we can do with interesting Muppets, which is only so much, you know?
And there's, I think there's a large portion of the movie that just feels like a slog.
Yeah.
You know, I think that all of the action sequences are fine, but I think that there are things that we had already seen before. You know, I mean, we could talk about the second Death Star, which, come on, I mean, do they really not have any other ideas? you know, the attack on the Death Star is different, but we saw it at the end of Star Wars, so it's kind of like, yawn, okay. You know, the speeder chase is different, but we saw sort of a different version of that on Hoth at the beginning of Empire Strikes Back. You know, I think that the battle with the walkers and, you know, the Ewoks and everything, you know, it's just,
yeah,
the whole thing feels like a retread of Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, and not in a good way.
That's kind of why why I like the Sarlacc bit, because that's a very different sequence than had been in any of the other movies.
That's,
you know,
true.
That,
yeah,
one, you know, they there are, I mean, in terms of, I think you, I don't remember if you talked about this on the podcast or not, but I mean, I find movies nowadays very hard to parse what's going on.
We talked about that, yeah.
Yeah. The Sarlacc scene, there are a lot of different angles. There's what Leia's doing, there's what Luke's doing, there's what R2-D2's doing, you know, Lando, there's Han Solo, there's Boba Fett, there's this, you know, random people fall. And you know exactly what's happening in the entire scene. It's a very, it's an impeccably directed scene. It's very well done, and I like that. You know, the speeder chases, I think that goes on for a little too long, but it is a racing and it is exciting, but...
Well, I think the whole movie goes on a bit too
long. Yeah, I was going to say, everything could have been cut by a minute.
I think all of the official running times of all three of the original Star Wars are over 2 hours, but the actual movie portion of Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back is under 2 hours. And the actual movie portion of Return of the Jedi is, I think, 2 hours and 7 minutes or something like that. You know, it's long. And it's just, I think that you know, there are things about it that definitely could stand to be trimmed.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that we necessarily needed to see the racing scene. I don't know that it's that interesting.
Well, it's what I found especially hilarious about the racing scene is, like, it keeps going, like, you know, all right, you know, they outrun one guy, he crashes into a tree. All right, well, then they have another, you know.
There's two more guys.
Yeah. You know, I like the Ewok fight. I like the whole Ender. If you can't tell, I fucking love Ewoks, but...
Well, I'm glad, yeah, and we'll talk about the Ewoks, because I do think that the Ewoks get a bad rap, but...
But, you know, it's like, all right, well, we see them use this trap, and then we see them use this trap, and then we see them use this trap, and then we see them use... And it's like, all right, that could have been cut by a bit.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I mean, the point, yeah.
But again, I think it all goes back to the idea that George Lucas, this is really the first instance where his lack of restraint is really showing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you see that in the creature design and all the Muppets running around and the puppets and the stop motion things and all this kind of stuff, right? The Ewoks. I think you see it in just the length of the scenes. You know, I think you see it in the length of the movie. You know, I think you see it in the sort of... You know, oh, well, there's the Death Star, but it's bigger. You know, there's all this stuff that's just like, it feels like they were running out of ideas and didn't have a good idea of what this movie should be about.
For as meandering as Star Wars is, it's a lot tighter and, you know, in a way more poetic. And this is just, I mean, it seems like every action sequence ends with everything blowing up in this movie. And, you know, this is much more of a stuff blowing up movie.
It is, yeah. It's. I think it's, you could consider, I mean, obviously Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back have a lot of action.
Yeah.
But at their heart, I think they're adventure stories. And I think that this movie is an action movie. You know, it's there to show us spectacle, which is fine. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a fine thing to do. I like those kinds of movies when they're done well. And I think Return of the Jedi is done well, but I think that it's just, you know, I mean, maybe I'm contradicting myself a little bit, but I just find it like the action sequences don't feel fresh enough. You know, there's too much of it that just feels like they're technologically 6 or 7 years later and they can pull off more impressive stuff. And so they're like, well, let's do this again. I don't know that we need to see that again.
This is one of those technically, you know, technically excellent movies that just doesn't have enough heart. I mean, there are, you know, the scenes when, you know, all of the dialogue scenes and all of the character stuff is very, very well done, and we will get into that. But, you know, the action scenes are just perfunctory almost in what they mean, you know? They're
perfunctory, but they're the bulk of the movie as well, which just is weird. And, you know, I think that, you know, looking at the totality of Return of the Jedi, I really do feel that it's all about protecting the brand. You know, there's nothing new here. You know, I think that, you know, Lawrence Kasdan actually argued, well, a couple things he argued, one he won and one he didn't win. The one he didn't win was what I said before about killing Han Solo, which I think actually would have been an interesting way to take the movie and would have added some needed, you know, character stuff for Leia and Han, which we don't really get in this movie all that much. I think the other thing that was interesting that originally wasn't in the script was they go back to Dagobah and we see Yoda die. And Lawrence Kasdan argued that we needed to go back to Dagobah. We needed to see Yoda again because we needed to close that off. And this is kind of like the transition over, you know.
And that was definitely the right decision because that's I mean, we will have to talk about that scene in detail, but that's probably the finest scene in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I think that you can really see where some of the instincts are right and some of the instincts are wrong. I mean, you know, it's funny because we haven't talked a lot about The Force Awakens, which, you know, we'll do a podcast on in a few weeks. But I think that one of the things that gives me hope for the new movie is that Lawrence Kasdan was involved in it, you know, and you know, maybe his instincts have atrophied over the last 30 years. I don't know, but I don't really know what he's been up to since Return of the Jedi. But I think that his instincts in terms of storytelling are very good, and George Lucas's instincts in storytelling are very bad, to the detriment of Richard and I, who have to watch the prequel trilogy over the next 3 weeks.
No, Lucas is, I think, very... It's interesting, because I don't know if we'd want to get into a Roddenberry versus Lucas thing, but
sure,
there are
not?
Some... There are some similarities in that, you know, what we talked about with – we talked about a lot with Next Generation that, you know, he was very good at, like, setting the pieces in motion. But some instincts like, well, you know, we can't have the crew disagree or, you know, aren't very good. And it kind of thrives when other people are – taking, you know, that creation and running with it.
Because I think that, you know, to kind of go a little bit more into Star Trek, you know, we obviously talk a lot about Star Trek on our other podcast, Trekabout, and, you know, we're watching Deep Space Nine right now, and I think that's one of the things that I appreciate the most about Deep Space Nine is that it does take the idea of Star Trek and it takes the world and the characters and it just runs with it in a very different direction.
It's the first post-Roddenberry show,
He had really
no input in that at all. Yeah,
I mean, the only input he had was they went to him before he died and said, hey, we're thinking about doing this, and he went, all right. You know, I mean, that was basically it, you know. But yeah, I think that to a large degree, I think you're right. I think that you know, Gene Roddenberry and George Lucas are better when they're sort of not given that much power. And they're sort of like, okay, we'll go and talk to you and we'll get your ideas and maybe we'll act on it and maybe we won't. You know, I think that, you know, frankly, I think George Lucas selling the rights to the Star Wars universe to Disney was probably a good thing. you know, I'm no fan of you know, in perpetuity copyrights, but you know, as long as they're going to exist, I think that maybe this is a good way to go. You know, I think that Disney is going to be maybe a good steward for the universe. I don't know what Star Wars fans think about it, but I kind of feel like, yeah, this is probably the right way to go. But it's, you know, Return of the Jedi, you know, let's actually talk about the structure of the movie and the plot, because one of the things that struck me about this movie is it doesn't really have much of a plot. It's very plotless. And I think that's part of its problem, where, you know, Star Wars was a good movie because Star Wars very much was just a reimagining of those old adventure serials from the 40s, right?
And it has a very simple plot, but that's okay.
It's very simple, but it's also very episodic. If you don't like what's going on the screen, wait 20 minutes and you'll get a totally different plot. I mean, yes, of course, you know, there's progression and characters are sort of there and they're not there and they're coming in and out and they're meeting and having interactions. But over the course of the movie, it really is very, we're doing this, then we're going away, then we're doing something else. And Empire Strikes Back obviously is not that movie. It's much more adult. It has a lot more resonance with character and emotion. And then you get to Return of the Jedi and you don't have any of that. Well, and so it's very, very, you know, there's plotless can work when there's a lot of emotional resonance. And this movie doesn't have much of that. And so it doesn't work.
It's like, you know, this makes a lot of sense, because Return of the Jedi is fairly episodic. You have the bits in Jabba's palace. You have the Sarlacc pit. You have, you know, Dagobah. You have, you know, you have Endor. You have, you know, this battle. You have this, you know, and while there is a bit more intercutting, especially towards the end of events, you know, it is trying to be the same kind of movie that Star Wars was, except at this point, the characters have grown up. We've grown up. Everything's a lot more complex. And frankly, it's not a simple adventure story anymore.
Right. I mean, we know the extent of the evil that is Darth Vader and the Emperor. Yeah. We know the extent of the evil that is the Empire, you know, as much as we need to. You know, this is not a universe that thrives on verisimilitude, right? I mean, we don't really get a sense of how this is actually all hanging together, but it doesn't matter. It's a good and evil story. And you know, we know all that. We come to Return of the Jedi, and you're right. It just kind of sits there.
Yeah, they don't really they aren't ready to make the next step into, you know, as dark as this movie should be. And yet they're trying to. I mean, even if it had kept in the same stasis as Return of the Jedi, as Empire Strikes Back, it would be good. If they had made Return of the Jedi like they made Empire, that would be fine. But they're trying to, it feels retrograde again in a way that, I mean, this is the most childish feeling of the movies.
No, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think that,
yeah. And not in a way that, again, I say, you know, Star Wars is one of those movies of my childhood. I go, you know, it's a grilled cheese and tomato soup movie, but you know, it feels youthful, but not childish. You know what I mean? It goes to that part of myself that was once 7, you know. Return of the Jedi feels like pandering a little bit. It's not.
Well, it's pandering to the people that loved the original Star Wars, and it's also, I think, pandering to other instincts. I mean, you know, there was a whole controversy a few weeks ago about Disney deciding to not make and sort of, I don't know if they're not making it, I don't know if they're recalling it, but all of the Slave Leia merchandise is going away. And there was a lot of scuttlebutt about that, about how dare they, this is a good thing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that stuff, I mean, I don't know that I have much of an opinion
I do want to talk about Slave Leia.
No, I do too. But I think my point is that that's another instance of Return of the Jedi pandering in a way that Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars did not.
See, okay. I mean, I know that, you know, Carrie Fisher has famously, you know, talked a lot about that costume in interviews. You know, she hated it. She, you know, and for obvious reasons. I mean, especially the intent of it is definitely to put this character through a humiliation. It is a form, in a way, of torture, but it's one which I don't think worked out. I mean, whenever we see Leia, she's either, you know, dressed in, you know, in this, she's dressed in combat gear through a lot of the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we first see her in, you know, Star Wars, she's wearing that long robey dress. when she's in Cloud City and she gets, you know, some nice clothing, you know, it's a very long conservative dress. When she's with the Ewoks, she's wearing, you know, this is a character who, you know, her preferred clothing style is fairly shaped, you know, it's not, she doesn't dress sexy in a way. And I mean, the rest of the movie does not sexualize her in this way, you know, and
I would even take it a bit further and say that Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back don't know that sex exists.
That's definitely fair in a let's not show much of the kissy stuff, you know, kind of way. Yeah.
It's a very childlike, I think, Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back in their sort of understanding of sex is very childlike, not childish. And yes. I think that in Return of the Jedi, it's childish.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that I think the intent is for this costume to be horrifying. I mean, it's supposed to carry home so much that this is how degraded she is being by Jabba the Hutt. And I think, I mean, the rest of the movie does not, you know, damsel her, you know, it, or anything. This is a movie where everybody's saving everybody else by this point of the franchise, of the series.
But,
you know, she... But there are so many people who have taken, you know, Slave Leia as a sexual fantasy. Yeah, I think that's where it falls apart.
That, I mean, you know, this is a big conversation, but I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that, frankly, a lot of people watch this movie when they're kids.
Yeah.
And you imprint on things when you're kids. I mean, that's where fetishes come from, honestly. You know,
Any
psychologist will tell you that. So I think that that's part of it. I don't know that we can really criticize people for having this sort of fantasy.
No.
Because, you know, that's kind of creepy. I don't think we should police people's thoughts. There are a lot of women out there that were really, you know, when they watched Return of the Jedi, they were let down by this, you know, because, I mean, let's be frank. I mean, there is no other female character. I don't think we see another in Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back.
The only other
one we see is Return of the Jedi. The
Many Bothans Died Lady.
Yeah, her.
And the Twilight, the slave girl who gets killed.
Yeah, her. Okay, yeah, fine. but she doesn't have a name, and she's there as she's basically there as a prop. You know, I mean, that's not. I'm talking about like an actual female character, not a prop. Right?
No, and you know, Many Bothans Died is a one scene wonder. You know,
right? You know, and so the Slave Leia. I don't even know where that name comes from. I think that is kind of
that's
gross
fair.
in kind of a weird way too. You know, I mean, we don't, that's never said on screen.
Well, I mean, you know, she's put in chains and, you know, dressed, you know, in thinking that, you know, I think, you know, what I see on scene is on screen as somebody who has been turned into a sex slave. So, you know, that, I hate to be so frank about it.
No, I'm with you, but I just think that you know.
You know, I would say that the costuming, I think, is the worst part of it because, you know, again, it's the camera, the direction doesn't particularly, it's not like we have loving scenes of her ass or anything like that. It's not like, you know, the camera is not inviting us to ogle her in any particular way. She uses her chains of slavery to kill Jabba. I mean, that's about...
Which was, again, I hate to beat this drum over and over again, but that was one of Lawrence Kasdan's
ideas. And that is the right decision to make for it. You know, that is...
It absolutely is.
The second that she sees, you know, she is... Because, you know, through the rest of it, it comes off as her waiting for her moment. And the second she gets her moment, you know, she strikes. But, I mean, maybe if they had made a they could have made a skin-tight outfit for her that wasn't, that was still covering her. That would show, you know, all right, she is being, you know, treated in a degraded fashion. But, you know, it's
Well, I think that, I agree with you that the camera itself, you know, does not sort of objectify her. I mean, this is not a male gaze sort of situation.
Which I do appreciate about the scene, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, Leia, who is, you know, one of the only female characters in the entire in the first three movies, is made to be a literal prop. And I just find that problematic. You know, I think that, yes, you could say, yes, they were trying to torture Leia. They were trying to break her. You know, Jabba the Hutt is disgusting. I don't know why Jabba the Hutt would be actually attracted to a female human, but whatever.
Would he be attracted to a female Hutt?
I would assume so. But, you know, I think that what this really is, again, this is a case of missed opportunity, and this is sort of like misfired instincts, because Leia was always a character that was very strong and was not sexualized in any way. And it feels it feels kind of gross, and it feels kind of like a misfire to think that the way to make her humiliated is to sexualize her.
Well, here's the thing. I mean,
because you know, female characters like don't need to be sexualized.
There is a lot.
It's okay if they're sexualized, but I don't think that they need to be, and I don't think that it's kind of gross that it's done in this way.
I mean, you know, Han Solo is also turned into a literal prop in this movie. That said, I go back.
He's not wearing well, like chaps.
You know,
like this.
Go back to the original Star Wars, where she, you know, where Princess Leia is captured, interrogated, and tortured, and yet there is nothing rapey about that scene.
Yes.
I mean, we are not to, you know, we are not to understand that Darth Vader is torturing her by rape. Is that, you know, that is not.
And I think
that is not at all in the subtext of the scene. And so,
but I think that you know, there's, it just clicked for me that there's another problem with the way that Leia is treated in this movie, is that in multiple ways she is identified as a woman first, right? Like, she is Luke's sister, she is Han's whatever, she is wearing a bikini. We, you know, like, there's weird things about the movie that keeps going back to the idea that Leia is not a person first and foremost, she's a woman.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's what in a way it's what defines her, you know. But because she is the only woman in the cast, you know, it becomes her, what defines her. That is a, you know, typical thing. I mean, you have the, you know, you have different characters and the chick, you know, that's a tradition in a lot of group shows, you know, because.
But I think that's a problem.
Of course. And it's something that, you know, I mean, I was watching an episode of Buffy the other day and realizing that there are, you know, at for the most part in the main group, three women.
Right.
And so they, you know, they're able to be characterized by their, you know, the show even reverses that by having, you know, Xander be the guy in the group for a lot of it.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I mean, you know, I think we should move on to something else, but I think that, you know, the bottom line here is that, you know, in all kinds of ways, in the conversations that we've been having over the first three Star Wars movies, I think that you can really see in Return of the Jedi, I think perhaps more than any of the others, that this really is a product of a white male viewpoint, white male heterosexual viewpoint. And it's, I don't think that there is malice intended here. I don't think that this is something, you know, George Lucas is not rubbing his hands together misogynistically and going, ha ha ha, look at the slut, she gets what she deserves, right?
But no.
I think
we cheer for Leia when she gets, you know, we are to be horrified by that, and we cheer for her when she kills Jabba, you know,
But it's that sort of unthinking misogyny, it's that sort of unthinking racism that, you know, is so prevalent in society. And I think that's why it's a problem. And I think it's why it's a problem in Return of the Jedi, because again, Leia was not, she was not a sexualized woman in the first two movies.
And again, I would say in the rest of the movie, she does not get sexualized. You know, it deals with, you know, her relationship with Han is completed, but I don't see any real problems with that. That's fine. You know, good for them. She is at the, you know, height of her tactical skills, you know, when it comes to going on missions and everything. You know, she's fine in that regard. You know, the rest of the movie doesn't treat her like, you know, I would say the rest of the movie doesn't treat her like she's a woman first and foremost. It's just that scene, I think, leaves such a bad taste. If you would cut that bit out entirely, I don't think we would be having this conversation from her.
No, of course. But no, I don't think we would.
You know, she's treated the same in the rest of the movie as she is in the first two movies, I would say.
Well, and I think the other thing that sort of, you know, is in that same problematic vein is, you know, the droid stuff. And I think that, I don't know, I you know, the more I watch these first three movies, the more I'm like, what the fuck was George Lucas's problem? Like, you know, you get like this scene of like droid torture in the beginning where, you know, 3PO and R2-D2 are being processed, and you've got the droid who's screaming in pain. And why can droids feel pain? I don't know. And the old droid is being ripped apart, and you know, it's played for laughs, and it's just like, it's so odiously creepy, and I don't get it.
Yeah, there's one, like, it's one thing to create a universe in which, you know, droids are treated as second class citizens. You know, they are treat, you know, we see the Jawas, you know, treat, you know, basically selling them as slaves. You know, we see they are tortured for, you know, any reason, but you know, the series is unwilling to deal with the actual consequences of that.
Right.
I mean, we in no way by the end of this series think that C-3PO is anything less than human, but I feel like, Like, here's why I think you and I prefer Star Trek to Star Wars, because Star Trek very much deals with the implications of life other than humans, you know?
Yes.
You know, and, you know, that deserves dignity. That deserves, you know. I would say that, I mean, I know a lot has been said about, well, the Empire doesn't have any non-humans, you know, in its ranks, you know, and it makes sense that, you know, they would be speciesist, you know, and that's fine, but... You know, yeah, that and that's something that the narrative is prepared to deal with, frankly. But the narrative never deals with the fact that, by and large, you know, droids are treated as disposable.
Right, and I think that it's weird because more than anything else, I think that the Star Wars universe does a good job of identifying, you know, the rebels as the good guys and the Empire as the bad guys in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the ways that they could have perhaps, you know, made the rebels be even better is to actually treat the droids well. And I don't think that they're mistreating them, but I just think that they're dismissive in a way of them. And it's a problem. I mean, we like 3PO. We like R2-D2. I mean, I think in a lot of ways you could argue that R2-D2 is one of the main heroes of the story, you know, but, and 3PO as well. But they're just treated so badly by all the main characters and so dismissively. And it's like, it's not even really a thing that's thought about.
Yeah. See, I think life is a lot cheaper in the Star Wars universe just in terms of scale, like, you know, in terms of because of this, there is almost a feeling like, I mean, C-3PO is fluent in 6 million forms of communication, you know. That is how many billions and billions and billions of beings are there in this galaxy, and therefore, you know.
Trillions, probably.
I know. I mean, so, like, you see these Empire's troops all massed, and they're all cannon fodder, you know.
Right.
So many people in this universe are cannon fodder, and, you know, droids are even less than that, and that's just... I don't know, maybe it's a cynical view that I have, but if you're not a main character, you know, you are utterly useless. And
well, you
Star
know,
Trek has an official policy of, no, everybody, you know, has dignity and worth. And, you know, one of the things Deep Space Nine is showing us where the Federation has let things slip through the cracks. But, you know, we generally see it as, you know, that's a failure that needs to be addressed because, you know, these people aren't being served properly.
Well, and I think that you said something really interesting there, which is, you know, I think that Star Wars in a lot of ways is very cynical. And for a franchise that is about, as much as it's about anything, you know, the battle between good and evil, the battle between son and father, and, you know, reconciling those two figures. And we'll obviously talk about that in this movie because that comes to a head. But for a movie that really is about good and evil, it is very cynical, I think, in a lot of ways. And there are ways in which this movie in particular just feels very, you know, I don't get a sense that the Republic was any better than the Empire, at least in treating. I mean, they're assholes to the Ewoks. I mean, like, there's just, and the good guys, the heroes, the people we like in this movie are assholes in weird ways.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre to me.
Yeah. I wouldn't say cynical because I don't think it's that thinking, but again, and this may,
no, but I think,
you know, this is a product of us, you know, just like, you know, Jedi, we've gone to this stage with Empire and Jedi is trying to be two steps back. You and I and most of the people, you know, this is 20, 30 years later. We've gotten older. We've thought about the implications of this a lot more. And Star Wars leaves a lot of cracks that it just oversees. I would say it's so unthinking about how.
But I don't want to give it a pass just because it's unthinking. I think that, you know, unthinking misogyny, unthinking racism is just as bad
as
worse. And so, you know, to have a major, you know, franchise that is really cynical, I think is a problem.
I would say it's less that it's, you know, I wouldn't say that it makes it better or worse. I would say it's more that, you know, this is a failure of it. And Star Trek has always tried to, you know, as many flaws as we can see in, you know, the original series, you know, the whole, you know, your hero was a telephone operator, you know, meme. It's trying.
Which is ridiculous.
Well,
anyway.
I was going to say, number one, it is making a big statement by putting a black woman on the bridge crew as a main cast member. And as, you know, we pointed out on the Star Trek podcast, that was based on a Navy position, was it? Mm-hmm. That was actually a fairly you know, technical and high rank position. Yeah. So, which is something the audience would have known. But for all of the, you know, flaws in Star Trek, it is trying to be ahead of its time. Jedi we see as maybe a little too of its time or a little bit backwards. And so
I actually think a little bit backwards, because I think that the fact that it's based on adventure serials of the 40s, I think is very important to the whole, you know, sort of philosophy of Star Wars in a way. And I think that, you know, it's supposed to be entertaining. It's supposed to be just a lighthearted romp. But there's a lot of heavy heartedness to it that I think is really, really weird. And I don't know that it's really something that is, it's obviously, I don't think, thought about. I don't think it's planned. But I think that you're right, where Star Trek kind of tries to examine our worst impulses and sort of our unthinking prejudices and kind of really, at the end of the episode, have us be a little better than we were before. I think that Star Wars just doesn't fucking care.
Yeah. I mean, Star Wars is hampered by the fact, I find this a very weird position, because I think, you know, we've said, you know, I hate, you know, I know I hate when people, you know, nitpick and pick too much and, you know, try to figure – but I think Star Wars is hampered by the fact that it wants to be all things to all people. You know, it could
– yeah.
You know, I think it's great that, you know, kids love Star Wars, but I don't think it – maybe the original Star Wars, you know, does address the adults in the audience, you know, and does hit them. And maybe Empire Strikes Back does, but Return of the Jedi forgets that there are adults watching.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, that might be true, you know. And you know, too, I mean, I think that it's a good transition for us to talk about Luke and Darth Vader, because, you know, in a similar way, I think that whole resolution to that storyline is very, very pat in an unthinking way, and it's just very simplistic.
It's where, you know, it's the outline of where it all needs to go. I mean, this is the... You know, we talk about Luke confronting Vader as his destiny. It's the way the narrative goes. I mean, if you talk about destiny as the way plots happen, you know, that's – yes, Luke needs to confront his father. Luke needs to meet the Emperor. You know, Luke needs to be at a very dark position of almost being defeated. Anakin needs to redeem himself by saving his son and sacrificing. Like, all of those, that all works. I love all of the beats of it, but – I mean, I always found it very stupid. Like how bad is the Emperor at convincing someone to be evil by saying, you know...
He's not even convincing. He's just like, you are going to be evil now.
You know, well, yeah, I know. It's like, it's one thing. It's like, your rebellion is destroyed. You know, you can...
Do you want to maybe, like, offer him some money or something? you gotta have some sort of, like...
I mean, like, you know, look, the dark side can save your friends. You know, that kind of a thing would work with him, you know? That kind of but he's just saying, you know, you're defeated. Now kill me. It will make you evil. And, you know, right. I don't want to be evil. Okay. Well, I think you should be evil. I don't want it. No, you're going to be evil, you know. And
right. No, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, you know, we meet Emperor Palpatine and he's just kind of a one-note dick. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, he should be his introductory scene. He's terrifying. And. As the movie goes on, he becomes less so.
I mean, yeah, okay. I think that he's probably, I mean, he got here for some reason. I mean, he's obviously got some skills, and he lays a good trap for the rebels, right? I mean, he kind of convinces them that, you know, he ignores their sort of ploy to, you know, move the Empire's forces over to this other star system and keeps them at the Death Star. So when they get there, you know, I mean, this is all fine. It's, you know, he's obviously the Emperor for a reason. But my problem with it is that, like, I don't really get a sense that Darth Vader would really follow this guy.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's funny because I actually think that that's one of the things that the movie does well is, you know, it does show that Anakin Skywalker / Darth Vader is perhaps much more weak-willed than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's someone who will go with whoever is sort of like their most, right? And sort of the loudest voice in the room.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, and as we'll see, obviously, because the prequels are very much Anakin Skywalker's story. But, you know, we'll see how that happens. But, you know, at least in The Return of the Jedi, what we see is a man who is just very, very beaten down by a strong personality. And once his son comes in and is able to convince him to go back to the light side and sort of like, you know, all that kind of stuff. We see that again, he's very fair weather. He's going to go wherever the winds are going. And that's, I think that that's sadder than the movie realizes.
Yeah. Like you can see the, after the end of Empire Strikes Back, when, you know, they escape, I mean, that's almost the defeat of Darth Vader. And, you know, even though it's a victory for the Empire, you know, we see him almost crumpling in this movie and, you know, degrading as it goes on. And yet he's still a more charismatic villain than the Empire.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think that, you know, Darth Vader in this movie is really painted out to be some sort of like abused spouse or something.
This series has gone from, and you know, from what I know of the prequels, it hits this, it makes it the tragedy of Darth Vader, you know, from the, you know, the most badass villain in the galaxy.
And I think it's actually, I mean, you know, related to that, I think is sort of the implicit sadness that we sense when Yoda or Obi-Wan talk about Anakin, you know, like,
yeah.
I think that there is really something profound there about, you know, Obi-Wan and Yoda, who, when they die, they become ghosts and they're still around. And that happens to Anakin too, because he goes back to the light side at the very end of the movie. But, you know, I think that there is something very sort of sad about that, where they do realize that this is a man who could have been something great. And instead he, you know, I think there's something, I don't know, there's even something a little bit easy about it, because he just kind of goes, all right, well, I'm back to the light side now and I'm going to be a ghost forever. And it's like, okay, but
I guess, you know, what I see as the central of the movie is that both Obi-Wan and Yoda think that Anakin is irredeemable. I mean, they're the ones who have said the entire time, you know, once you go to the dark side, you're there forever. And who's puppeting that? Who's parodying that? Darth Vader. It's too late for me, you know, I'm on the dark side. Yoda and Obi-Wan are completely wrong. The only one who, you know, the one who realizes that, you know, the dark side is not forever, that you can turn back, that you can, is Luke. I mean, Luke is the one who, Luke disagrees with everybody who says, you know, there is no good left in Anakin, you know. Obi-Wan says that, you know, he says, you know, Anakin has died.
And, Darth Vader says
Darth
that.
Darth Vader said that, you know. Luke this entire time says, no, there is still good in him, and he's the one who proves to be right. And I guess, you know, in the end, that's the victory. The victory is, you know, that redemption is possible, which is, again, contradicts the cheapness of life in the rest of this, you know, universe. But, you know, yeah, there is almost, this is two movies. This is the larger scale, which is a little fucked up. And then there's the personal story, the drama between, you know, Luke, Leia, Han, Darth Vader, the Emperor, all of, you know, the main cast, which is very well done. And this movie thinks the interesting thing is the epic.
Well, I think that's actually, you know, really interesting, because one of the things that struck me about that scene between Luke and Darth Vader, where they're talking and Luke is trying to convince him, you know, you're not completely irredeemable, you can come back, you know, et cetera, et cetera, is really, it kind of feels like a therapy session. Like, you know, like Luke is Darth Vader's therapist in that scene. And obviously, I think that there's some interesting resonances there between the father and son relationship. I mean, you know, this is kind of a standard trope in a lot of things. I mean, I actually don't know what Darth Vader, I don't know what George Lucas's, you know, family situation was, but there is a real sense here that sort of like, you know, in a real way, this is kind of like how, you know, Luke comes from a broken home and Darth Vader is the abusive father. And, you know, Luke is trying to like bring him back and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think that it kind of works and kind of doesn't work. I don't know that, you know, the entire impetus of the entire three movie arc was just this father and son thing. You know, it makes it feel a bit small, but I don't know. It works, I guess, right?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what Star Wars is about. I mean, like I said, I know when the original trilogy was released, this was about Luke's story. You know, this is about somebody coming, you know, learning about who he is and, you know, learning true wisdom and, you know, redeeming his family line and all of that. When the prequels were released, the series became about Anakin and, you know, what he is and, you know, his fall and his redemption, you know. So I wonder what the new trilogy is going to make it about, frankly.
You know, but I don't, you know, I think it's funny because I don't know that I necessarily agree that the trilogy is about Luke. I mean, I think that it is and it isn't, right? I mean, I think that you could really argue that the central the central character of the first three movies is the relationship between Anakin and Luke.
Yeah, and
you know, at the end of the movie, it's all resolved very nicely. I think that, yeah, you know, the funny thing about the movie as well, I think, is that, you know, it's something that is just striking me now, is that Star Wars to a large degree is sort of about who you choose as your family. And, you know, yeah, you kind of look at it and say, you know, on the one hand, okay, well, Luke is drawn to Leia, Luke is drawn to Darth Vader because they are family. But at the same time, you have really profound relationships in the three movies that have nothing to do with family. You know, I mean, I think you could argue that the Rebel Alliance having like all these different, you know, species in it is kind of indicative of that. I think that, you know, Han and Chewbacca being so close, you know, there's all these weird things about it that sort of are nice. And I think that that's why the central tension of these three movies really is sort of like, is I think, you know, love or romance or whatever you want to call it versus sort of this weird cynicism. Yeah. And at the end of the movie, I think that the love triumphs, as it has to, because, yeah, you know, again, this is a good versus evil story. But I don't really get a good sense of how, you know, it just seems to be, well, you know, love and good is more powerful than evil. And it's, yeah, like, well, I don't know.
Because,
I mean,
you know, so says the law of Hollywood. You know,
well, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Like I said, my opinion of the trilogy goes down as it goes further on. I like Star Wars the best. I like Empire Strikes Back. I don't like Return of the Jedi. I mean, if I'm going to sit down and watch a movie, I will still watch the first one. But again, I think it's...
But... Ewoks.
Ewoks. I do like Ewoks.
And I think that the Ewoks are given a bad rap.
Oh, the Ewoks are fucked up if you think about them.
How so?
Oh, they see a bunch of people. They begin worshipping one as a god and decide to... you know, homage him by cooking and eating his friends.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's fucked up.
Well, they don't know that they're his friends.
Why doesn't C-3PO... C-3PO tries to say, those are my friends, you know, don't do that. And they still roast him.
Right, but they believed he's a god, but he didn't show any god powers. And once Luke used the power of the Force to float C-3PO, they all backed off.
I know.
And then they helped them win the Empire, you know, war.
Well, Jeff... Yeah.
So it's fine. It's
all
good.
Why do you think then that Ewoks get a bad rap?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, there are sort of things about it that are a little tiresome. You know, I think that the Ewoks are maybe a little too cute, which kind of, I think, is part of the reason why they're so cute.
I mean,
is to make us think that it's misdirection, because, you know, yeah, they are instrumental in bringing down the shield and destroying the Death Star.
If they had been lizard people, number one, we would be terrified in the scene when they've got them, you know, at spear point, and they would, you know, look a lot more dangerous, you know, when they're speeding around. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think in a sense, I mean, you know, if you want to argue about themes, I think that the Rebel Alliance being this small ragtag group of people defeating the Empire at the end of the trilogy is kind of, you know, mirrored in the Ewoks, because the Ewoks are very threatening and they're very cute.
Yeah.
And, you know, Leia and Han are patting them on the head and all kinds of stuff, you know. And then at the end of the movie, they're very instrumental in winning the battle and ostensibly the entire war. So there's part of that. I think that, you know, I don't know. I think that maybe the Ewoks are they're in the movie a lot, and I think that they're sort of indicative of the sort of wrong impulses of George Lucas to make this more about creatures. You know, I think there's a lot of things about it, but at the end of the day, I don't think that the Ewok stuff is egregious, and I think it works really well, actually. And I think it's one of the creature parts of the movie that actually seem integral to the story.
Yeah, I'm good with that. It's interesting that a lot of the, you know, aliens that we see are one-offs. This is, we know, one of the few that we actually see, you know, a glimpse into their society, I would say, in the trilogy.
That's true, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I guess, you know, that's one of the general bits about Star Wars that I don't quite like. I like the, you know, we see all of these, you know, one version of all of these different things in Jabba's palace, you know, and they're more interesting when it's just this one alien rather than, you know, referring to, you know, okay, well, this is an entire planet of these things, you know. But that's just a general feeling about Star Wars I have.
And I guess, you know, finally to wrap this conversation up, I mean, I think that at the end of the movie, you know, does it make sense that Anakin, Yoda, and Obi-Wan are there looking on lovingly at their creations, I guess. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think that, you know, the movie itself, the name is very sort of meaningful, and it sort of implies and promises something, yeah, which is sort of like the return of the Jedi, right? I mean, that's kind of the running theme of the whole movie, that that Luke is now calling himself a Jedi Knight, and he is doing all kinds of Jedi tricks, and yeah, he's able to kill, you know, Jabba the Hutt's people, and he's able to do this, and he's able to do that, and sort of bring, yeah, his father back over to the light side, and
yeah, the,
you know,
implication
all that stuff.
Is from there, you know, Leia's going to start training in the Force. You know, she'll become a Jedi too. You know, they're going to have this new Jedi Order based on this sense of redemption, and, you know, trying not to learn from them is, yeah, I mean, that's great.
So I think it's nice because it kind of wraps up the entire, you know, three picture arc, in a sense, into being, you know, I think at the end of the movie, what we have is people who have won a extraordinary victory. And, you know, the last generation is looking on and sort of saying, yes, you did a good job.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fine. I think it works pretty well.
Yeah. It's, you know, well done, son. Good for you.
Right.
I'm proud of you.
So I don't know. I mean, I think,
and I, you know, I do respect that that's all done wordlessly. Like, it struck me this time that, I mean, the entire last couple of minutes in the movie are just, you know, imagistic. It's no, you know, there's no dialogue, you know, once the, you know, that, no, you don't understand, he's my brother, you know, then it's all just, you know, scenes of celebration and, you know, them just nodding, you know,
and I
like that.
And I kind of wish that, you know, Return of the Jedi had more of that restraint in it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, frankly, I'm not looking forward to watching the next three movies. I think that I'm, you know, I mean, they're just going to be train wrecks, I think. And it's really going to be interesting to see exactly how Star Wars goes so wrong. Because, you know, I don't know. It's funny. I mean, watching the three original movies, again, I'm not a Star Wars fan. Like, I have some vestigial...
Yeah.
Protectionism toward it because I did like it as a teenager a lot, but I don't know that I get it. You know, I don't, and that's fine. I mean, I don't know that it doesn't have to be my thing, but the movies themselves, I think Star Wars is fine, Empire Strikes Back is pretty good, and Return of the Jedi is pretty not
Let
good.
Let me ask
and,
you a terrible question.
Okay.
I mean, is that just because we're snobs? Like, is this the kind of thing, like, you know, we don't like pop music, you know, because it's just like, oh, whatever.
I like pop music.
Well, I don't like pop music. But you know what I mean? Like, is this just a thing that is Star Wars just much more mainstream than Trek, and that's why we're not into it?
I don't think so. I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, I like mainstream things. I don't really get it. I think that Star Wars is a fine movie. I like Empire Strikes Back, and I don't really like Return of the Jedi, and that's as far as I take it. I mean, I don't know that, you know, there's much there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I mean,
like I said, I have, you know, cousins who were kids when the prequels came out, and, you know, they were about as old as I was, you know, watching Star Wars for the first time, and, you know, they fucking love it. And I, you know, part of me wonders, you know, if I had just seen this, you know, because I was at that, I was what, like 16, 17 when the prequels started coming out. So I was definitely at that age where I didn't want to go back and, you know, watch the same stuff I did as a kid. You know, is it just that I didn't imprint on them? Would we have a different opinion? It's going to be very, because I'm seeing them for the first time.
The prequels, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm very curious to see what my reaction is.
Maybe we'll love The Phantom Menace. I don't know. we'll have to see. You know, and I'm sure we'll talk about this when we get to the end of this whole seven-episode season of Trek About Presents. But,
yeah,
you know, I think that that's kind of going to be the open question at this point is Star Wars. Like, what is it? You know, like...
What Star Wars? What the fuck? Anakin, what the hell does that mean?
All right, well... That is our conversation about Return of the Jedi. Next week, we are going to be talking about The Phantom Menace. But before we let you go, if you have any thoughts that you would like to share about our conversation on Return of the Jedi, please do so on the post for the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. Our social media username is trekaboutshow, where you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And we also do a Star Trek podcast, which you probably know if you're listening to this, but maybe not, where we are doing Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which Richard is enjoying very much. So please join
Don't
us for
speak
that.
For me.
All right, calm down, Richard. Well, next week on Trek About Presents, we are going to talk about Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace. So be afraid. Be very afraid.
I'm not afraid.
You should be.
No, that's not the line.